technical problems. I'm not quite sure what's going wrong now. Okay, can you... It's not ideal. Can you see this? Can I make it a little bit darker, just at the expense of risking? Yeah, I'll leave it at that, okay? Can you read this? Okay, good. Right, you probably have heard it 20 times. I'd still like to...
Louder,
okay. I can try to... Okay, now I can... They seem to have got rid of that microphone completely because there were too many problems with it. So, all right, I really don't like standing so close to this. But if I move away, just do that sign with it. I'll try to be... Okay, so even if you've heard it 20 times, I'd still like to wish you a happy new year. On the 14th of January, I think you're not usually supposed to do this anymore, but I'll do it anyway. I hope it's going to be a successful year, one with lots of linguistics for you, and lots of good results in exams and things like that. I'll say a few words about the exam afterwards. Okay, first I'd like to, as usual, make a few announcements. First of all, I've just uploaded the no lists for morphology and syntax. No lists referring to the list of terms which are intended to give you an idea of what is particularly important, what is maybe less important but good to know, and other things that I just said to add something interesting for people who would like to find out more. Second, apologize for the delay in uploading the results of the first assignment. Yes, I had promised to do it before Christmas. I had everything ready before Christmas. I didn't upload it before Christmas because it was madness before Christmas. I cannot say more than just apologies. I didn't intend to not load it up, but yeah, I hope you can accept that. Good, a few words of feedback on the assignment. The total number of points one could get was 14. Basically, every correct answer got 4 points. I've also indicated already on StudIP that this was not a question of fail or pass. You had to do it in order to be allowed to take the exam. If you haven't done it, a few people haven't submitted. Some of them will have left university, others will have left the lecture and gone somewhere else. But if you are still here and you would like to have this assignment counted and it says not submitted, then you really need to talk to me very soon. Okay. So since this wasn't a question of fail and pass, I was actually quite strict. For example, if you misspell the name Magden, then I just basically said, no, if you write Magdad or Madgen, no. Okay. Anyway, so just in case you're wondering why you have a lower number than expected, that may be the reason. I'd like to give you a little bit more feedback on some questions. I also noticed that I haven't uploaded the correct answers yet. I will try to do so before the weekend is over. Okay, there was a question about the Zeitschrift for Anglistik and Amerikanistik. And quite a few people didn't realize that in the library only the most recent issues are actually on display and that the rest of the issues are kept somewhere else on this sort of semi-floor, this half floor between where you enter the library and higher up. So this is why some people didn't find it. Quite a few people haven't heard of the MLA database. You're not alone, there are quite a few people up in higher semesters who also haven't heard about the MLA database, but it's an extremely useful database of things that have been written in linguistics, particularly useful because it doesn't only contain books, but it also contains information about papers in collection of books or in journals, and this is often a very good way of finding otherwise miss by just going to the library catalogue and entering, let's say, morphology. Okay, then you get lots of books written about morphology, but not necessarily articles that deal with the same topic. Then I was, well, unhappy is the wrong word, but I was quite surprised to see a lot of answers that for the question referring to the etymology of Puch, the history of Puch, that quite clearly didn't come from the OED, at least not from the full OED as it is available online. So you must have gone somewhere else and got this information from somewhere else, even though it said using the OED as a quotations database, using the OED as a source, the OED online. So there again, I was quite strict. I didn't expect sort of every single word to be the same, but I expected you to use the OED online. And if you said something like 1920s, then this was quite clearly not from the OED online, but then it was somewhere else. I don't know what. Many people have trouble answering the question about searching the quotations text. I got a lot of answers referring to the number of different senses given in the OED, but there is actually an advanced search which you can choose. And if you do that search, then you actually only search the quotations, i.e. the sentences or stretch of sentences given in the OED to illustrate the meaning of a particular word in context. And a lot of people said there are seven senses or something like that, but in fact it's a much higher number. I wanted to ask you to, I asked you to do this so that you can see the full potential of the OED. Or of the OED online. Then a really tricky question was the question about whether we have a license for the journal, the Corpus Linguistics and Linguistic Theory. The answer is yes and no. Yes, we have one, but because it is through a so-called Nationallizenz, we don't get the very last, the current year. And that threw a few people off. I accepted yes as an answer. No is, strictly speaking, wrong, only for the last year, really for the current year, but you don't get access to 2010, but by now perhaps you do get access to 2010. And question 10 turned out to be, and I didn't plan this, a really tricky question, because it was the question about the oldest entry for the keyword linguistics, corpus linguistics, in the online catalogue of the library. There are 51 hits. A lot of people gave me the last hit on the first page, which is the 50th, but there is one hit on the fifth, on the second page. I didn't even intend this, but it turned out to be a source of a lot of hits. Good. As I said, I will upload all the expected questions on SUDIP, and I will do so very soon. A few words about the exam. Remember, it's in April, early April. We will put a sample structure of this exam in both online and also in the sort of, we hang it up in the department so that you can look at it. It will consist of 6 short questions and 1 essay question, and I think I may have said some of these things before. Question, well, I think last time I said a bit more than 100 words. It will be a little bit more, but don't count words, please. I saw a lot of people last time spending time counting words, but that just... I'm not going to count your words, okay? But I just want you to use the space that's there. The exam covers the whole course, but language counts 40%. Okay? I think I may have said most of those points before. More info in terms of actual structure, etc. Good. Any questions about anything before we can go on doing linguistics? Yes?
I just want to add that it's quite hard to access the OED from at home, because you have to access the university network,
yes,
via the VPN client, which does not work for around 95% of us.
Okay, I use the VPN client from home quite a lot, and it works fine for me. I don't know. If it doesn't work for you or for others, has anyone else had problems with the VPN client connecting from Okay. Bug the Dashing Center or whatever it is called now. Let them know, and maybe it's a problem of your configuration, or maybe it's a problem of the setup there. It works for me, and it works for many other people, so it should work. Try bugging them. Good. Any other things? Shall we do some linguistics then? Okay. Semantics. I will upload, by the way, reading for next week, where it says to be announced, about text linguistics. This will be uploaded today, I hope. But definitely before the week. No, it will be uploaded today, full stop. It will be uploaded today, and I'm also going to upload an additional optional reading about semantics, which will actually correspond in some ways to what I'm saying today. So this will be, you will be able to read up on these things in a bit more detail. Good. So what's semantics? Easy definition or short definition, the study of meaning communicated through language. It's not as easy as that, of course. There's a lot one can say about the word meaning, and the actual intricacies of how it works are a little bit more complex. And that's basically what the lecture is all about. And I'd like to introduce some of those problems with a recipe for Swiss cheese fondue, which I actually happened to eat last night. Pure chance. Now, this is something which I found on the internet. What's a recipe for Swiss cheese fondue? Well, you need 3 cups shredded Gruyere or Swiss cheese. You need 2 cups shredded Emmentaler, Gruyere, or Swiss cheese. And then you need all-purpose flour, and you need white wine and things like that. What's all about this? Do we know what Gruyere is? It's a type of cheese, and in fact it's placed in Switzerland, so it's Swiss cheese. Emmentaler, well, Emmentaler is a valley or a place, or a valley in Switzerland. Gruyere, it's Swiss cheese. What's odd here? Well, in a way, Swiss cheese is not a type of cheese. Well, yes, but on a different level, isn't it? At least for us, or at least definitely for the Swiss. Now, in the English-speaking world, this seems to be different. There is a type of cheese which you can go and buy in the shop, and if you ask for Swiss cheese, then you get a specific cheese, and not Gruyere, and not Emmentaler, as far as I know. So this seems to be a case where different languages or different cultures have a different ordering of what we could call the lexicon. The lexicon meaning the storage that we have in our minds of words and what they can refer to. Let me give you another nice example of the ordering or the culture-specific, not necessarily ordering, but the culture-specific meaning of a particular term. And this has to do with being on time. What does it mean for you to be on time? How many minutes can you be late how many minutes can you be late before it really counts as being late? And the example that I have here comes from a train company in the northwest of England where I used to work, and where I also used to occasionally take the train and get very annoyed at their tendency to be somewhat delayed, or somewhat, well, a lot delayed. And they have to have statistics about how late they are, how often they are late. And they say, of course, they're very concerned about being on time, etc. And then they define punctuality. Punctuality is defined as the number of trains arriving within 10 minutes of the advertised time expressed as a percentage of the number of trains that ran. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, but is 10 minutes late for a train on time? Let's go to Switzerland. Okay. Now, this is in German. Okay. These are partly clichés, of course, but that's, this is culture-specific ordering of the lexicon. Die Schweizerischen Bundesbahnen setzen die Latte höher. And the important bit here is at the very beginning, wenn ein SBB-Zug als pünktlich gelten soll, darf er künftig nicht mehr als nicht mehr 5, sondern nur noch 3 Minuten zu spät sein. So quite clearly, northwest of England and Switzerland have different perceptions of what can count as being on time. So quite clearly, meaning isn't very straightforward. There are things that might influence what is meant by a particular expression. And culture and different cultures may be one of the influences that we can look at. I'd like to start with looking at some concepts, meaning, reference, sense, etc. Let's just, well, we could spend a whole lecture basically on what does meaning mean. There is a book in philosophy about the meaning of meaning. This is a difficult question, but I'd like to still exemplify a few of the issues that we can look at here. We could look at different types of, well, let's just look at those three sentences. The Prime Minister is in the car. The Prime Minister should be in the car. And Gordon Brown is the Prime Minister. Well, is that true? Not quite, right? Well, anyway, let's just say Gordon Brown, we should now say, was the Prime Minister. In the first case, we are referring to a particular person who is in the car, and if we were to stand next to the car, we could actually point to the car and say, first of all, this is the car, and in it is the Prime Minister. So we can quite easily see what the meaning of those blue terms are, or is. What's the meaning of should? This is much more difficult to say. It expresses more of a, an evaluation on the part of the person who says it. This is something, well, it's a modal verb, it's something that expresses nothing very concrete in the same sense as the car is something concrete, but it's more of a grammatical meaning and also expressing some kind of attitude. It should be, but probably isn't, or might be. And in the third case, Gordon Brown is the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister doesn't really have the same meaning as the Prime Minister in the first case, because in the first one, the Prime Minister is the actual person. But the Prime Minister in the third one is more a social, not capacity, but a position, political position. So we can't really say that the two instances of the Prime Minister have entirely the same meaning. So it's either a specific person or a role. And I've already said that the meaning of should isn't quite easy to define in the first place. Let's first look in a bit more detail at reference. I was late before, not before, I was late because the computer crashed. I can say this, and I can point to my computer, which actually did crash before lunch, but I was not late. And I can use the words the computer to refer to this entity which is standing in front of me. It is a linguistic expression that I use. And it identifies the referent, namely this particular computer. We call this the referring expression. Very importantly, there is no immediate clear-cut link between the referring expression and the thing that I'm referring to. It's sort of an act of referring to it. It's not that when I say the computer, that it's always this computer. It could be a different computer. So it could be referring to the computer at home. And if I say the computer in front of you now, then you can see that I mean this one and not the one I have at home. Notice also that reference isn't necessarily linked to something that really has to exist. We can talk about two unicorns, no problem. We can talk about Harry Potter. We can talk about other things that have no specific physical reference. And still we can, just to exit, simplify this a bit further, have a look at this. There was once an old man, and we have no problem assuming the existence of a particular reference who was an old man, who lived in the forest. If I replace this with an old elf, which is an entity that presumably doesn't exist in the real world, it doesn't, and nothing changes from a grammatical point of view. And we can take up that person with the personal pronoun he, we can refer back to that entity, whether it's something that exists in real life or not. He lived all by himself and was very lonely. One day he met a frog here on the etc. There is a lot of noise going on this time. Can I ask people who would not like to listen to the lecture but rather talk about other things, either to be quiet or to leave the room? Thank you. All right. Now we could say that it's either, well, we could say that something can refer to something that has no specific reference. We can do this, but what we could also say that it's basically referring to something which we, when we talk to each other, create in a particular discourse world that we build together. But let's not go into too complex ways of putting this. There are different types of reference. I have a cat, let's say, and then I can point to the cat and say the cat is on the map. The sun is very hot today. The plumber we used to see at university turns out to be my next door neighbor. And here's the fourth sentence that I would like to, the fourth extract I'd like to talk about. A man came in with a child. I didn't recognize the man, but the child is my cousin. We have different ways of referring to entities here. In the first three cases, we have several expressions which I've marked red here. The cat is on the mat. We are using the same article here, or determiner, namely the. And in the last case, we have the indefinite article, a man came in with a child. From a grammatical point of view, we talk about definite and indefinite articles. And this is because this is a case of definite versus indefinite reference. What do I mean? In the first case, I'm referring to a cat that I know, that I see, that is my cat, and this is, well, I can point to it. In the second case, a man is someone that I have not seen before. It's a new entity that's entering, and therefore I cannot say this is the man that I've been talking about. So the definite linguistic expression, the man, which I can use later on, I didn't recognize the man. I can use that when I have already introduced that person as now having definite reference. Sometimes we can assume that something is definite or known, like the sun. The sun is very hot today. Which sun? Well, there is only one sun in our discourse world, in a way. We know from science that there are many other suns in different planetary systems, perhaps. But if I say the sun, then I can assume that you and I mean the same thing, that we're not talking about the sun many light years away. Okay. This is a chair. I can use this to point to this particular chair. Or I could say I'm going to IKEA tomorrow to buy a chair. Is this the same kind of reference? Well, in the first case, I can point to the chair. In the second case, after I bought it, I can probably also point to the chair. But now, I'm referring to something which is in a way more abstract, less specific. We can assume that it's going to be something with four legs, possibly three, but then it might be a stool, well, anyway. And it's something that IKEA has in stock, but which one in particular, even if I have in a particular model in mind, which one it really is, which of the 17 that they have in stock is not necessarily clear. So it's not as specific as saying this is a chair actually pointing to. Let me demonstrate this in a bit more, well, with a different case. Ken wants to marry a woman with blue eyes and grey hair. Now, I can go on in two different ways. I can assume that we know who it is. Okay? In fact, she has a name, she's called Susie. Which means that this woman is actually a specific woman who exists and who's known Ken for a while. But maybe Ken just has this ideal. I don't really know who it is, but if I ever marry, then it should be someone who has blue eyes, grey hair, and in this case, she has to be younger than 40 years. So, again, this is a much less specific way of referring to this person, to this, in a way, this slot for the person that could be filled by a very specific one, but in this case, it is a non-specific reference. Here's a joke, a cartoon, which employs those different types of reference. After 4 weeks of syntax, you're going to get a little bit more light fare today from me. So, but this one is usually not considered to be extremely funny, but let's see. In the first one, this is from Dilbert. I believe there is one true soulmate for every person. And he then says, he must be very busy. Yeah, I didn't think that you were going to find that very funny. I meant one person. Your way would be stupid. Now, this exactly works on this distinction between specific and non-specific reference. There is someone, some hypothetical person for everyone, and you only have to find that person, and that will then be the true soulmate. Okay? And the way Dilbert understood it was, well, there is one poor person in this world, and he or she has to have this particular voice as he, function of being the true soulmate for everyone. Okay. Right, the next ones are going to be more fun. Right? A short aside. Okay? It goes back a little bit to the features of spoken language which I introduced in my last virtual lecture, the Christmas lecture. I walked into the dark room where the music was pumping. Then I saw this bloke. I said, who are you? And he said, Scrubber. What's happening here? I'm going into a new room, into a place where I haven't been, a dark room, and I see someone for the first time. Then I saw this bloke. Wouldn't we expect to see a bloke? Because it's a new, like the a man came in with a child. But what you can apparently do in spoken language, particularly in spoken language, is to introduce a new reference with a definite linguistic expression, even though, I mean, we have a definite expression because we use demonstrative pronoun, even though we haven't actually introduced that person before. So this is yet another one of those features which are particularly okay in spoken language, different type of sort of spoken grammar, but which would not be okay in writing. A final, third type, or further type of reference. Have a look at those three sentences. The giraffe has a long neck, giraffes have long necks, and a giraffe has a long neck. In all three cases, look, in the first case, I can actually point to a giraffe. Take my children to the zoo, and one of them says, oh, look, the giraffe has a long neck. This could be a very specific giraffe. But it could, of course, also refer to the fact that we know giraffes to have long necks. It's like a prototypical feature of giraffes. It's a sort of a generic feature. And that's why we call it generic reference. So when you meet a giraffe, then it's very likely that the giraffe is going a long neck. You can do this with the a definite noun phrase, the giraffe. You can do it with a plural noun phrase, giraffes. And you can even do it with the indefinite article, a giraffe has a long neck. And in all three cases, it basically means the same thing, namely that the species of giraffes has a long neck. We use this kind of reference to make statements that are just generally true, timeless statements, law-like properties, or rule-like behavior. There are quite a lot of interesting features about generic reference, and I can only scratch the surface of this. Doctors are well paid. Can you say the doctor is well paid and mean it generically as a sort of feature of the trade or the profession of the doctor? Can you do the same with a doctor is well paid? Possibly, but this is sometimes it's only possible with one form, sometimes it's possible with several forms, and with the giraffe, with all three. Not quite sure why. Turtles lay eggs. True? What percentage of turtles lay eggs? 50? Yeah? Female turtles. Malaysians are good at battling. They are, they're usually pretty good, and they usually will win the world championship or how many Malaysians play badminton and are particularly good at it? A lot less than 50%. But we have no problems with that statement. Dogs have four legs. How many percent of dogs have four legs? 99.999, whatever. And if we see the odd one that lost the leg, then it's not going to make the statement wrong. So, this is sort of working. So it seems that generic reference doesn't necessarily have to have a connection with the percentage of everything that could potentially belong in this or be referred to with this referring expression. Anyway, that was another aside. Okay, a few words about reference versus meaning. Reference is an important part of meaning. If I have those two sentences, who's the woman over there? She's my sister. Do they have the same reference? Yes, I'm referring to the woman over there. And I refer to the fact that this woman is my sister. So in terms of reference, we're talking about the same entity. The two different referring expressions are referring to the same referent in real life. But they have different meanings. The expression the woman and the sister, or my sister, do not have the same meaning. Okay, here's another joke which you're going to find a lot more funny, I think, although I'm not saying that it's the best joke. But that, again, in a way refers to something that makes that is relevant here. Users ask to enter a new password. Penis. Sorry, your password isn't long enough. Okay. I will not go on to explain this joke. Many linguistic expressions clearly mean something, but they don't refer. Some people talk about designators there, but that's a term that I don't want you to memorize. So, modals or determiners, what do they mean? They do not mean anything that can have reference, but, I mean, remember I asked the question of what should mean. Well, it's something that designates something, relationship, grammatical relationship, or perhaps attitudinal relationship. Okay, we could also quickly we could ask how logical language is, and that's related to sense as well. In mathematics, things can be very logical, or tend to be, or are very logical. If A is larger than X, and A equals B, then we know, and we know for certain, that B is larger than X as well. The president thought that the city of Copenhagen was in Norway. The city of Copenhagen is the capital of Denmark. We can now not say, therefore the president thought the capital of Denmark was in Norway. So, again, this has got to do with reference, sense, meaning. There are different types of meaning, and Finnegan also mentions those in the reading that you've done for today. He talks about referential meaning and two other types of meanings. Referential meaning, I'd like to give you a quick definition here, is the person, the object, the abstract notion, event, or state to which a word or sentence makes reference. This is the kind of thing that I used when I said this is a chair or it's a referential meaning. But there are two other types of meaning. Social meaning is one, and this refers to additional information that these words seem to carry, seem to convey, about the social characteristics of the speaker, who says it, what social class does that speaker belong to, etc., and of the situation in which they are spoken. You can also say something about the level of formality. This is the social meaning, and then we've got the affective meaning. This is the kind of connotations that we have. Is this something bad or good? Information conveyed by a linguistic expression about the attitudes and emotions of the speaker towards a content or the content of an expression. So whether something is said in an angry way or whether something is evaluated about negatively or positively. People usually combine the two additional meanings that I've now introduced, social and affective meaning, together to say that these are the connotations of a word. And they are therefore calling it associative meaning. The denotation, on the other hand, is the objective, referential content, the actual physical, in this case, chair that I'm referring to. Just as a quick exercise, don't know whether you know all of those words, but one can quite easily demonstrate the different types of meaning with those synonyms: hoax, trickery, swindle, rip-off, ruse, and strategy. I'll just give you a minute to work out the associative, the two different types of additional meanings rather than the referential one for yourself. This is also the quick break, almost in the middle of the lecture. So just 30 seconds. There's actually a fourth one. And this has got to do with the kind of words that words can co-occur, or the kind of collocations that we often meet or see with other words. What's the meaning of pretty and handsome? Hello, you are... Either I'm saying things that are particularly boring today, or you are particularly not yet in, we're back at university mode. This can be quite nicely illustrated that those words have different collocations by looking at those slots here. Are you talking about a pretty village or a handsome village? Pretty? Pretty village. Are you talking about a pretty woman or a handsome woman? Both? Someone said both. Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. Color? Who's in favor of pretty? Okay, who's in favor of handsome? Okay, pretty color. Garden? Favor of pretty? Pretty garden? Handsome garden? I'll leave it to you in the end to find this out yourself, but with some it's very clear. In heritage, for example. Who's in favor of pretty in heritage? Handsome in heritage? Okay, very few people are putting up their hands. Handsome in heritage means a large sum. Handsome proportions? Pretty flower? Quite often the choice between the two is really quite restricted. Although you might choose one or the other, if you chose the other, it is actually something special. And let me demonstrate this on the basis of pretty woman versus handsome woman. Can you say handsome woman? Well, let's look at handsome woman here. This may be a little bit too small for you to read, but there are 16 instances in the British National Corpus, which is a huge corpus of 100 million words, where we find handsome collocating the woman. Marion, a rightly handsome woman in her mid-30s, or a fearsome, if handsome, woman. Or we have a handsome woman with a streak of sensuality. He saw a tall, handsome woman dressed with careful, expensive informality, etc. Now, if you compare this to the use of pretty, then this is not entirely the same. A handsome woman is not the same as a pretty woman. There's usually something, I wouldn't want to say odd about her, but there is something specific, either age-wise, or that she is a very tall woman, or maybe someone you have to be slightly afraid of, etc. And that seems to be expressed by combining two words that are not usually combined in this way. But the usual meaning of pretty woman is very different and not marked in that way. Okay, some people also talk about sense, and this is, I think, a lot more old-fashioned. It refers to this idea that every word has a stable sense, which we can see in a dictionary. We also have this idea that this stable sense is represented in the lexicon as a sort of particular meaning or sense of this expression. So it's almost invariant. Okay? Nowadays, people have a much more flexible way of considering meaning, but this is something that is still very common, and of course it makes sense to use this in an introductory lecture. I've already introduced the referent prime minister, or the lexical expression, I should say prime minister, and we could give a definition. Sense in that sense in that sense refers to like a dictionary definition. A chief minister within the national parliament. And we apparently, or the idea is that we order the entries in our lexicon, and we have relations or relationship between elements in the lexicon. Okay, and that's what I would like to talk about for the next few minutes. This is what we're doing when we're doing lexical semantics, a description of the relationship of these senses. And we could, for example, come up with a set of features that a prime minister has to have in order to be a prime minister. Or, and this is introducing something which is probably going to make you smile, what's the meaning of woman? What features does a woman have to be a woman? Now, I'm going to show you an extract. Please don't sue me for this, or don't think that this is my opinion. There is the exact same thing for a man as well, but I thought, because I have the nice extract here, I'd show you this one. This makes a point about, I guess about different meanings, effective, for example, versus the referential one, but also about the fact that, why don't I just throw it to you then? I'll read this to you because it's probably too small. There's trouble brewing, guys. You have to hope that this study is flawed, but the evidence seems irrefutable. 7 months ago, scientists at Europe's annual human reproduction conference suggested that the results of a recent analysis revealed the presence of female hormones in beer, and suggested that men should take a look at their beer consumption. The theory is that drinking beer makes men turn into women. To test the theory, 100 men were each fed 6 pints of beer within a 1-hour period. It was then observed that 100% of the men gained weight, talked excessively without making sense, became overly emotional, couldn't drive, failed to think rationally, argued over nothing, had to sit down while urinating, couldn't perform sexually, and refused to apologize when wrong. Okay. No further testing is planned. Now, obviously, this is not the meaning of woman. This is not the features that are, in the sense of sense that I introduce, necessary to define the woman. But we have lots of connotations, cliches, etc., etc., that feed into our knowledge of the lexical item woman, and these are, of course, nastily exploited here. What people have tried to do, or tried to do a while ago in the 70s, if I remember correctly, was to come up with a finite set of features that could be used to define each and every word in the language. The necessary components of a word, the components of meaning of a word. And this is, in a way, as you can see, quite easy to do with man, woman, boy, and girl. How many features do you need to distinguish between a man and a boy and a woman and a girl? Well, you can say that they're all just human, so that doesn't actually help us. Okay? They're all human, so this is not something that you can use to distinguish. But you can say some of them are adults, others are not, and some of them are male or not. Notice that it's also interesting why I chose male here, not female, and said that the man is minus female. But that's another issue. You will talk more about language and gender next term in the follow-up of this lecture. So really, we need only 2 features to distinguish between those 4 terms. And people have tried to do this for all words in the language. This is, of course, very abstract when we talk about, very difficult, sorry, when we talk about abstract concepts. They're also, again, like the example of woman that I introduced, much more complications for this theory, or for this method of assigning meaning, than we would want if we look at real-life language. What's the definition of girl? Well, you can say that the girl behind the counter is 50 years old. Well, you don't say the girl behind the counter is 50 years old, but you refer to someone behind the counter as the girl said that. Or adult women go out with the girls to have fun. So the meaning of girl isn't quite as straightforward as minus male minus the dog. Notice also that lady, well, what is it? Lady is plus female, plus adult, plus aristocratic. Well, you can have lady doctors, you can have cleaning ladies, not aristocratic, lady doctor, not aristocratic, etc. So there are additional complications. Here's another one. What's a bachelor? Unmarried adult male? Many women in here, they're going to be bachelors as well, bachelor of education. Okay, so not just that. But what about the Pope? That wasn't about the Pope, was it? Anyway. Or Tarzan. Do we refer to those two entities as bachelors? We have all sorts of additional elements that come in here. Age, someone who is 85 or 90, does it make sense to talk about a bachelor here? Freedom to marry. Okay. Pope is not allowed to marry, so cannot change the status of bachelorhood in that sense. Lifestyle, etc. Right, I'm possibly running a little bit out of time, so I'm going to skip over Wittgenstein here and this longish quote. I'll leave that to read to you. But it basically leads to the idea that a better way or a different way of looking at meaning might be to talk about certain prototypes. If I gave you, if I asked you, what is a bird? Give me a typical bird. You are not going to say pheasant. You're not going to say peacock. You're not going to say duck. You're going to say, well, in German, you're probably going to say Spatz, sparrow. Right? In English, it's the robin, the wolf kid. Now, again, this is culturally dependent, as we've just seen, because in England, or English-speaking world, the robin, it's not quite like the Spatz, it's very close. But there are more or less prototypical birds, and we can arrange different linguistic expressions around a prototypical center and say, yeah, it corresponds more or less closely to the prototype, which in this case here is a robin. So, I think it's fair to say that the meaning of linguistic categories is not always defined by a set of discrete features like plus minus adult, or something like that, and that we have many more blurred edges, many more sort of gradient phenomena as a result of this. Nagyushvitska has put this quite nicely. Language doesn't reflect the world directly. It reflects human conceptualization, human interpretation of the world. This, I think, also accounts for the fact that different cultures may have different prototypical types of, for example, verb. Also, concepts can change over time. And I'll talk about semantic change a little bit at the end of the lecture. I'd like to have a brief excursion into Kant and Mass nouns. We have cow as a word, as a noun, and we have the plural cow. What's the plural of petrol? Not petrols. Why? Because you can count cows, and you can't really count petrol. It's not an entity which, well, if you have petrol, you take half of it, it's still petrol. If you take a cow, you take half of it, it's no longer a cow, it's half a cow. So it's the shape in itself is important for our understanding of the meaning of cow. So we don't have shape and precise limits for petrol. And this is the distinction between count and non-count nouns, or mass nouns. But we can, again, with language, do much more than that. We can say Betty likes to gorge herself on cake. Can we count cakes? Yes, of course we can. say whenever in that demo we can also say whenever Betty gobbles down a cake, her diet starts tomorrow. So there are words which can be both mass noun and count noun. And this has to do partly with the way we sort things in our mind, the way we conceptualize the things that are around us. So in other words, with the conceptualization of reality. And this vocabulary, in a way, slices up the world, and language-specific options exist. For example, in English we count strawberries. We can say one or two or three strawberries. We can do this in German as well. Any native speakers of Russian here? Okay. Klubnika you can't count, right? You can. Sorry? Can you say Adna Klubnika? What would be the next one? Dva Klubniki? You can? Klubniki. Yeah, my Russian is very, very, very short. Okay, but let's try with the next one. I was taught that you can't. Furniture, in English, you can't. Möbel, in German, you can. Not necessarily, but you can say ein Möbel, zwei Möbel, drei Möbel. Möbel, in Russian? You can't, right? No, okay. So it seems to be specific to certain languages, and there are other examples. One thing about Russian which I know is that, for example, colors are split up differently. In English, the primary colors, there is a restricted range of primary colors. Blue is one of them. In Russian, there are two further, well, not two further, but what we would call in German and in English blue is actually split up into two separate primary terms, sinyi and goluboy. Again, right? Okay, good. So it seems to be language specific in many ways. Okay, talking about the order of the mental lexicon, here's a quick extract I got from Emma, who was 4 years old at that time. She said, when I grow up, I'm going to be an adult, or a teacher, or a princess, or a cooker. I think she meant cook. So quite obviously, the ordering of the different parts in the lexicon haven't quite been fixed yet. Why? Because adult and teacher and princess and cook aren't on the same level. You can be an adult and a teacher. Okay? Adult is in a way on a different level. And this refers to the fact that we seem to be ordering the lexicon hierarchically in our brains. And there are different ways of expressing or different terms to use to describe this ordering. For example, we can talk about and this is also mentioned in Finnegan, about hyponymies or taxonomies. We can talk about superordinate terms and subordinate terms. So a rose is a kind of flower, and a flower is a kind of plant, just as much a plant as a tree is a plant. And we can see the hierarchies involved here. So this is a kind of relationship. And we talk about those words on the same level as cohyponyms. So what Emma did was that she considered four words to be cohyponyms, because she used the coordinating conjunction or, which are in fact not cohyponyms, but adult is somewhere different. Again, things are not quite as straightforward as that. What is a whale? Kind of fish? Well, yes, lives in water, swims, or can be eaten, I don't know, about other features he would like to add. Probably not as a defining feature, and also a very controversial one. But, of course, it's not a fish. So we can talk about fog taxonomy. So sometimes what linguists have come up with as orderings of the lexicon may actually differ whether you're a layperson or a specialist in whatever field. Okay, we have taxonomy. There is another one, which is meronymy. Examples are body, trunk, arm, well, and then the arm can be split up into upper arm, forearm, and hand. What is this? This is again a relationship of, a superordinate and a subordinate term, but in this case it's not a kind of relationship. Hand is not a kind of arm, but it's a part of relationship. Another relationship which all of you know is synonymy. What is synonymy? Well, the lay definition would be identity and meaning. An expression that can be used to refer to the same reference. Examples: couch and sofa. Stubborn and obstinate. Now, is stubborn and obstinate really the same? Does it refer to the same kind of quality of, let's say, a young child? Well, yes and no. Because we can observe in language that true synonymy, words that refer to exactly the same kind of things on all different levels of meaning, denotation and connotation, virtually don't exist. Why is this the case? Well, it's not economical to have this situation. If two things refer to exactly the same thing, can be used in exactly the same context, then we don't need one of the two. Synonymy was one, but then of course we have antonymy as well, which is the opposite. Now this is something which we can observe most easily among adjectives. We can, for example, look at true and false, and we can see that one is the opposite of the other. Young, old, and buy and sell. We can further distinguish, though, different types of antonymy. What's the difference between true and false and young and old and buy and sell? Well, in the first case, and again this is looking at it from an ideal point of view, from a very sort of point of view which puts things into clear-cut categories, something is either true or false. Now we all know, of course, that in real life we can say something like this was quite true or rather true. Or dead and alive. It's also a long way to go. You can't be very dead. But of course, at the end of a long term, you can feel very dead. And you use dead in a context where it can become gradable. But from a sort of prototypical point of view, true and false are non-gradable. Young and old, however, are clearly gradable. It's a very old man, rather old man, very young man. And then buy and sell are something special because they're called converses. Well, if you buy something from someone, then that person sells it to you. So the meanings are related in some kind of reciprocal relationship. There is something interesting about antonymy in the sense that if you have something like young or old or tall or short, then there is usually one of the two words which you choose as a default, as an unmarked case. You ask, how expensive is this book? You don't really ask, how cheap is this book? Or perhaps, better example, how fast did she run? You don't say, how slowly did she run? Now you can, of course, ask how slowly did she run if you want to make a specific point that she was extremely slow, or let's say the point of the whole game was to run particularly slowly. Then that would make sense. But the default situation is that fast is used as the unmarked case. to introduce. In fact, a set of three or rather four terms. And particularly the last two cause some concern among students usually. Let's start with homograms. I will lead you to the lead mine. Okay. Not the most imaginative sentence, but it's one that I found to illustrate homograms. Okay. What is a homograph? Same spelling, different pronunciation. Lead versus lead. Something that's related, homophones. She met the knight in the middle of the night. Well, we have the same pronunciation and different spelling. Now, since we have same spelling, different pronunciation, and same pronunciation, different spelling, the third one will then be homonyms, homonymy. I never lie when I lie in bed. We have different words, clearly, but same spelling, same pronunciation, as it says here. Now, this is not the only case where we have the same spelling and the same pronunciation, because there is also something that's known as polysemy. What is a lock? Well, you can have a lock in the door. You use it to close, to lock the door, yes. To make sure that no one can walk through. You can also have a lock in a river. This is a meaning which maybe you don't know. German translation? Schleusen. Okay. So, is there any kind of connection between the two meanings of lock? Well, it's the same spelling and same pronunciation again. Is there any kind of connection between those two meanings? Well, yes, because in both cases, we have something which stops something else or somebody else from going through. In the first case, it's perhaps a human being that wants to go through the door, and in the second case, it's water that's being stopped. So we could say that conceptually the two are related. And that's what makes it into polysemy rather than two words which have nothing to do with each other but just happen to look alike and sound alike. Now is this the only meaning of lock? No, sorry. Are these the only meanings of lock? You can also have, of course, the lock of hair. What's this? Is this a case of polysemy with the other two, or of homonymy? Clearly a case of homonymy, because the two words happen to sound alike, and they are spelt alike, but they do not have any conceptual connection. So that's why we say that the relationship between the lock of hair and the lock in the river, or the lock of hair and the lock in the door, is that of homonymy, while in the first case, lock in the door and lock in the river, this is a case of polysemy. Here is one which is not very funny, I think, which illustrates homonymy. Fine for parking here. Okay. Probably not fine. Yes. Okay. Don't know whether everyone knows this, but just look at it again. What's the difference, really, then, between homonymy and polysemy? Because how do you know whether something is conceptually related or whether they are two completely different original meanings of two different words? Well, the way to find out is to look at the etymology of words. And that sometimes requires going to something like the Oxford English Dictionary and asking the question whether two words that have nothing to do with each other nowadays may actually be related, and you may then say, in this case, it's a case of polysemy. Or, alternatively, you could just say, we look at the distinction between homonymy and polysemy from the point of view of today. Today, the words are not conceptually related, and therefore we talk about homology. In, let's say, exam situation, if I asked you, let's see, possibly in something like an oral exam where you have more time to respond in a more flexible way, or even in a written exam, if I gave you two words and asked, is this a case of polysemy or homonymy, or what's the sense relationship between the two? Then you say, and you don't know, because you don't know whether the words actually at some stage may have been related or go back to the same word. Then you say, well, I assume that there is no relationship between the two, no conceptual relationship between the two, therefore they are homonyms. So if you're not sure, always explain, and even if you give the wrong answer, you might get full marks for the right way of getting at the wrong answer. Okay, another relationship that I'd like to briefly mention is that of metaphor, and I'm sure you've heard about that in school. A couple of examples. He throws the hole with a board, the chairman of the board. He paid for room and board, and boarding school. Now, not all of them are metaphors. The first one is an actual, literal board. The meaning is extended. A boarding school is a school where people, where pupils stay overnight and they lie on a board, well, I guess on something that's nowadays called a bed. You pay for room and board. Room and board as in representing the table that food is eaten from. Metaphors are a very strong reason or very common reason for the very large number of words that we have in English, because meanings get constantly extended metaphorically. If you mention metaphor, you also have to mention metonymy. Rome has decreed that celibacy will be abolished. The crown wants all my money, but not the crown as such, it's the crown as a symbol, symbol for the government, in this case, or tax office. Metonymy works by the contiguity or association. Contiguity meaning sort of two things literally or perhaps not quite literally touching itself, each other, being related to each other, between two references, whereas metaphor works on the similarity. Something that is similar doesn't necessarily have to be contiguous. Okay, I'd like to end this lecture with a few words on semantic change, on changes in meaning over time. It's a case of diachronic change, change over time. Now, changes in the meaning of words tend to be changes in the lexicon as such, but also changes in the meaning of words, tend to be related to cultural aspects of our society. If we have new entities, new inventions, new facts, new things that we see when, let's say, America has discovered and a whole set of new plants, etc., is encountered, we need new words. So, we have new social realities, and we need new concepts that need to be named. And we could use completely new words. We could borrow new words into the language, which, as you remember, was quite common in English. Or we can also change the meaning, either by a metaphorical extension or whatever other means, of existing words. Now, semantic change isn't something that is very, well, it's not usually considered to be very, it doesn't always go in a typical direction. It tends to be, as at least it looks like it from looking at it very superficially, something rather arbitrary or unpredictable. But let me just give you an example of a change over time. What's a video? Well, a video as a noun was first used when television came about. in the 1930s to refer that to everything that was displayed on a television screen. Then it was referred to a video recorder, which was developed in the 50s. Later then, it was most frequently, and I still remember this, used for a videotape cassette. Many of you will probably not ever, you will have seen them, but not used a VHS player, which was popularized in the 1980s. What's a video today? Any more modern video? Yeah?
Something on YouTube.
Something on YouTube. You think of videos as something that is online, possibly a music video. Again, that's another new meaning. So this quite nicely shows how one particular word, because of changing technological facts and developments, may come to be used for concepts that simply did not exist beforehand. We could also say, because it started off as something more general, that this is a specialization of meaning, and in a way a restriction of meaning. Okay. This is something that's quite common. For example, what does starve mean? Well, originally, it meant to die, just generally. Okay. To die of hunger is the meaning today. So it has become more specialized, more restricted. Same thing is the case for meat. Meat used to refer to any kind of food, and nowadays we refer to meat as the food that's provided by dead animals, okay? Animal flesh. So this is a specialization. The opposite is also possible, namely generalization to a larger range of contexts or meaning. The word arrive originally meant come to shore. It's got a Latin root in there. River is there as well. Arrivare, I guess. But nowadays, it's got a much more general meaning. You can arrive on a plane and there is no river around. Okay, or shore. What's a batch? A batch was originally very, very specific in meaning, namely a quantity of bread baked at once. Nowadays, it's just something that's handled in a single operation. And I can even, and I don't even mean this in any negative way, I can talk about you as the current batch of students. So, anything handled in a single operation, yes. I mean, you're all in the same lecture. Now, this has got to do with the way things refer to more specific or more general reference. You can also have other types of changes over time. Namely, something can come to have more negative or more positive associative meanings. And in fact, then even the denotation can turn into something positive or negative by way of doing this. Silly is a typical example, or not a typical, but a famous example. Silly originally meant blessed. There is a German word which is related to this. Anyone know? Silly. Nowadays, of course, it's been a long week. Okay, yes. Okay, good. Yeah, it happens from time to time. Yes. This is, by the way, one of the reasons, no, not this, but I recently was asked by someone among you whether I would like to, whether it would be possible to give you the slides beforehand. And I answered, well, I could, but I'd really rather not, because I would like to be able to ask questions and to ask you to think ahead and to, well, think about what silly might mean, and I don't want you to see all the answers already on the screen. Okay. Didn't quite work out this. Anyway, silly is the same word originally, or is related to the original meaning. Nowadays, of course, silly means something quite different. A villain meant a serf. Definition of villain here in the original sense, originally a low-born, base-minded rustic. Nowadays, it's a criminal. Again, this is just one option. The other option is that something can actually turn into something more positive. What's a knight? A knight has positive connotations today. Originally, in Middle English, a knicht was a boy, a youth, a lad, a servant even. Something very, very different from the knight today. And sophisticated turned from being a rather negative evaluation of something as being artificial to a sophisticated restaurant being very cultured, a sophisticated interior of a restaurant. Pretty meant something rather negative, cunning, crafty, artful, astute. And nowadays, pretty means good looking. So that's why I said that changes in the semantics of a word seem to be rather arbitrary. They can go into lots of different ways. Now, recent research has shown that it's not quite as arbitrary as that, but that seems to be the first impression that you get when you look at language change in the context of semantics. A final point on the role of the speakers in all of this. And this is slightly more theoretical. Of course, communication is a two-way process. If I talk to someone, then they try to understand what I mean in the same way as I try to formulate things in such a way that my conversational partner can understand them. And we sort of constantly, and this may sound a little bit abstract to you, negotiate meaning. Negotiate meaning in the sense that I need to constantly check whether you have fully understood whether I mean pretty to mean this or pretty to mean something else. And I'll actually give you a practical example of this in a minute. And small differences in the interpretation of the speakers may actually over time lead to such language changes that we've now seen. As I said, I'd like to exemplify this. What's the meaning of since? Since the first term, students have been doing even better. I hope I can say that in a year's time. I can look back to you, the batch of students here, and say they did very well at the exam, and now look at this, they have done even better. Since students have to do exams, they work even harder. Is that the same meaning of since? Not really, because there is a connection between the fact that students work and exams. It's not the only reason, but it's one reason why students have to work. So it's no longer a temporal relationship, but it's a causal relationship. So since, in that sense, has two meanings. Which is the earlier one? The temporal or the causal one? What do you think? Who is for the temporal? Okay, who's for the causal? Okay. Half and half divided. It's actually the temporal. Why? This. Hello up there. It's not quite finished yet. I don't receive. Okay, I really mean it. What's the earlier one? The temporal one or the causal one? I've already said it. The temporal one. Let's have a look at this. Since she has left him, he has been feeling miserable. What's the meaning of since here? Well, I think we could say to a certain extent that it's probably temporal. Yeah? She left him, and since then he's been feeling pretty bad. But you could also say, of course, that there's a connection between the two. Because she has left him, he is feeling miserable. Now, there was a time, presumably, when since could only mean time, or a connection in terms of time. But because, presumably, speakers started to interpret temporal relationships as having a causal connection. Well, if two things happen one after the other, then they probably have something to do with each other. You can perhaps see that through, and that's why I use the word negotiation, through renegotiation of the meaning, a new meaning might have slowly developed. I may have meant it purely in a temporal sense, but you as my listener may have read something into it and may have responded accordingly. And as a result of this, I will have changed the course of the conversation. And if this happens again and again and again and again, then maybe since can become what can become a different word in the sense that it has a different meaning. This is because nowadays people nowadays think that language use actually has a very strong influence on the grammatical structure of the language, since it's a grammatical word. Okay, the last few slides were much more theoretical than the rest, but I thought it was an interesting point to mention. Next week, and now the noise is going to start, I know, we're talking about text linguistics. As I said, I'm going to upload a reading about text linguistics, which is a required reading. And we're going to talk about information structure and what Americans call pragmatics. We will also do a lecture on pragmatics later on, which is a different meaning of pragmatics. But that's going to be in week 13, probably.